It's Thursday, March 3rd, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. In the world of entertainment, many interesting things go on, but many of them are simply not seen. Something that I think is really important has emerged from a recent article on Peter Guber. He is, after all, featured in the Scene Stealer column of the New York Times from Sunday's edition, and he's written a book about the importance of story to human life and to leadership. His book is entitled Tell It to Win, Connect, Persuade, and Triumph with the Hidden Power of Story. It's being published this week by Crown Business. Now, Mr. Gruber himself has been involved in many storytelling adventures, including the making of many movies. He, after all, is someone who's well-known in Hollywood. He has led, says the New York Times, an eclectic life in film and in sports and in different businesses. But here's the deal. When he writes about Hollywood and he writes about telling a story, it's very fascinating to see how this article ends. Michael Seaplay, writing about Mr. Guber, says this. But the personal thing, Mr. Guber said, is more than just a selling tool. It's also the point at which a story has its reckoning with the truth, or the storyteller's version of it at any rate. Quote, to create that touch and feel, you need to change somebody physiologically, psychologically. You need to be in the room, Mr. Gruber said. But once there, he warned, any lack of conviction will out. Now listen carefully to these quotes. Truth is a point of view, he said, but authenticity can't be faked. Now that is one of the most revealing statements I've seen in a very long time. Here you have someone who's a major player in Hollywood who says that truth is merely a point of view, but authenticity can't be faked. Now, that's the kind of postmodern ethical stance that makes sense, I guess, in Hollywood. But let's be honest, it makes sense in the local preschool, too. If truth is merely a point of view and authenticity can't be faked, then we can be authentic without being truthful. And that's a fascinating value system. But it's a value system that makes a great deal of sense to many of people in business and politics and entertainment and elsewhere. You know, I don't think there are many parents who would be impressed by a six-year-old who said, okay, I lied, but I was authentic. Now, we understand from a Christian perspective or from any kind of rational, reasonable perspective that authenticity only works if it's true. But it does tell us a lot, doesn't it? Here's a man trying to sell a book on leadership, and he's talking about the importance of story, and he's coming back to say, you don't so much have to be truthful as you have to be authentic. It reminds me about one of the controversies over one of the films that was nominated as Best Picture for the recent Academy Awards. The Social Network was based upon a book that included a lot of invented history and invented biography. And I remember one reviewer in the New York Times who said, I know the story isn't quite true, but it's exactly as it ought to be. I like this version better than the truth. Well, that tells us a whole lot right there. Let me tell you what. There are many instances in life where we're tempted to want our version better than the truth. But the reality is, the truth is still the truth. We're talking about economic realities in America. There's a great deal of conversation about it. And continuing this week, the focus of so much of the energy in recent days has been in Wisconsin, with a continuing issue there having to do with the governor demanding the end of collecting bargaining rights for public employees. And there are many Americans who look at that. And if they're just asked the question, should there be the right to collectively bargain, the inclination of many Americans is to say yes. Let me just remind you that what we're talking about here are public unions. They are public sector unions. In other words, their employers are the very people who are paying the taxes. And as even Franklin Delano Roosevelt recognized, when you give public workers the opportunity to collectively bargain, you basically hold the taxpayers absolutely hostage to those who are being fed by the taxes. Something wrong with this picture. Well, you want to know how wrong it is? Well, the problem is many Americans are watching this without any real knowledge of even the math that is involved. So let me give you just a little bit of math. How much in benefits is paid to a Wisconsin school teacher for every dollar of salary? That's right. For every dollar of salary, how much is paid by the state in benefits? 74 cents, 74.2 cents. So in other words, this collective bargaining has produced a situation of benefits in which you have benefits that are now 74 cents plus on every dollar of income. So in other words, you're paying someone supposedly $50,000 just to make up a salary, but the actual cost of that employee is well over $75,000. And that makes a huge difference. That's why the taxpayers of Wisconsin are beginning to do the math. Now, the other issue about the government has to do with the fact that there is a tipping point. And different social analysts and political scientists and theorists of times old, going all the way back to before there was a United States of America, have tried to think about this. But it's the power of the modern state that raises raises this to a new level of consideration. How many people can work for the government until basically we have, well, we have a government economy rather than a private sector economy? There are some European nations that can already answer that question. They can tell you that they are already on the wrong side of that equation. They're just not sure they can tell you what the tipping point is. But I do think it's a very healthy debate in this country. It's the kind of debate in which Christians may come to different positions on, in terms of certain policy questions. But there should be a certain consensus among Christians about the fact that we need to understand that a thriving economy is what allows persons to express themselves economically and to take personal responsibility and, for the glory of God, flourish in a way that just isn't possible if the government takes over and becomes the main economic actor in a society. We are poised, as we recognize, and I've already talked about this week, in a major sea change in terms of questions about things as basic as marriage. And now comes the report, of course, in the expectation that Maryland may be the next state to legalize same-sex marriage. If so, it will become the sixth U.S. state. And as you look at this question, well, let's just remember something. Just from America's history, Maryland was the Catholic colony. And when we were talking, I'm thinking in public, a recent interview I did with John Shelton Reed, professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, one of the points he made is that regions no longer mean exactly what they used to mean. In other words, you had in Maryland, a state that was after all named for Mary, the Queen of England, Mary Tudor, known by Protestants as Bloody Mary. Let's remember that that was the Catholic colony where marriage was determined by the Pope. And now Maryland is about to legalize same-sex marriage. Now, of course, we're a long way from Maryland's colonial history. And as Dr. Reed pointed out, Maryland's no longer even the most Catholic of the states in the Union. Now Rhode Island is, of all things, which was established by someone who was at least for some brief amount of time a Baptist, Roger Williams, is now the most Catholic state in the Union. But it is a reminder of the fact that we can leave behind a certain moral understanding and not even remember that it was back there in the furniture of previous times. My guess is the people in Maryland no longer feel any obligation to a scriptural definition of marriage as they're considering this question. And yet those who established the colony would have been unable to see a secular understanding of marriage and to separate it from what they know marriage to be. Another very interesting issue that's going to emerge a great deal more in terms of our cultural conversation has to do with biomedical ethics as attached to the issue of organ transplants. As you well know, there is a deficit of needed organs, and that means that difficult decisions are made about how someone gets an organ. For the better part of the American experience on this, since the experiments and then the practice of organ transplantation began, the basic moral structure has been first in line. In other words, you get in line, and the fairness has been understood about the fact that you get in line and the next person in line gets the next kidney, the next person in line gets the next heart, the next person in line gets the next liver. They're about to make a major change in that. And as it turns out, as reported by Gardner Harris in the New York Times, the new policy that is suggested by the United Network for Organ Sharing is that the first priority no longer go to first come, first serve, but rather to the young. It's a very interesting moral equation. The moral equation is this: the organ ought to go to the one who can use it most predictably for the longest period. It's a stewardship question, as you see, as they envision this. You have the stewardship of an organ. The example they give is of an 18-year-old accident victim whose kidneys are put into a 77-year-old individual. Well, there you have an 18-year-old kidney and a 77-year-old body. What is the ethics of that? Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? There's all kinds of moral debate to be had here. You have Arthur Kaplan of the Hastings Center, now of the Center for Bioethics, University of Pennsylvania, to say, quote, "If it's a choice between saving grandpa or granddaughter, I think you save the granddaughter. It doesn't make sense to give people equal access to something if some people fail to benefit," end quote. Well, that may be a logic that takes hold. I don't know. That may be where this is going. But let me suggest to you that the big question that ought to be asked here is how we consider the larger ethical context of who receives medical treatment and when we decide that someone is beyond the age of, for instance, qualifying for something like this. That's not a hypothetical issue. Right now in Great Britain, there's a cutoff time for dialysis. And by the way, if you don't have dialysis and you don't have functioning kidneys, you die. But that's simply the logic that has been factored in. I wonder how many Americans are ready to get invested in this question. My guess is that most Americans are going to be very much divided mentally and ethically over this question, because there's a part of us that's going to say first in line makes a lot of sense. Then there's a part of us that's going to say it should go to the person who has the greatest need and the greatest opportunity. But then you have to ask the question, who's going to make that determination? Who shall live and who shall die? It's one of the most important questions that can be confronted by any human generation, and it's going to be confronted by this generation in ways many of us had never expected. The Wall Street Journal had a very interesting article by Mitch Horowitz in recent days asking the question, when does a religion become a cult? Now, you may say, I think I know a cult when I see one. Like Justice Potter Stewart of the U.S. Supreme Court, when he was asked about pornography, said, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. A good many Americans think, well, I can define a cult. Well, he's trying to come up with a definition here because, well, after all, as he sees it, there is a danger in cults. But given our commitment to religious freedom, we need to be sure we can see a cult and know a cult and not accuse those who aren't cults of being cults. Well, he comes up with different ways of trying to describe it. He says that as he sees it, and he's quoting here psychologist Philip Zimbardo of Stanford University, the first mark of a cult is behavior control. The second is information control. And the third is thought control. And then he says also emotional control. And then he adds financial control and extreme leadership. Now, as with the question of biomedical ethics, I just want to point out that this is a very subjective form of evaluation. You know, if you're just going to use this kind of sociological definition of a cult, I think there are many people who would try to claim that any form of Orthodox Christianity is a cult. I don't think that's what Mr. Horowitz means here, but I wonder if he understands the consequences of what he's saying. You know, I define a cult by its theological principles. I define it as a Christian, unapologetically as a Christian. I understand that there's a difference between, for instance, denominations or churches, and then sects, S-E-C-T-S, and cults. And I'm dependent upon in previous definitions that I think are basically right, and that is a sect is a group that holds to Orthodox Christianity but adds additional practices or eccentric beliefs. And there you might consider something like the Amish who believe it's a function of the faith not to use buttons. Well, that's not a denial of any crucial Christian doctrine, but it's also something that sets them apart as somewhat eccentric. On the other hand, you take a group such as Christian Science. They'll be theologically defined as a cult because they deny doctrines that are necessary to the Christian gospel. And you can go down the line, of course. That's why Mormonism is defined by most evangelical Christians as a cult, and not because they don't make good neighbors, but because their belief system denies the gospel. Defining terms is really important, isn't it? You consider the issues we've talked about today, all of them are live issues in the culture. All of them require us to think and make sure we know what we're saying when we even use the words. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. Follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information about Southern Seminary, just go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. Mary and I and several of our friends will be taking a cruise to Alaska. We're going to leave the last of July and come back the first week of August. It's going to be a spectacular trip. I'm looking forward to it. We're going to be going with friends of the seminary. I hope you can join us. It's going to be a time of intensive fellowship and Bible study and good conversation. The only thing that can make it better is if you come with us. For more information, go to the website at albertmoeller.com or go to sbts.edu, and there you see the banner. Just click on it, and the information will come to you. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.